This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
Welcome to This Is Money show in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is This Is Money editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website this week. And it's hi-ho, hi-ho, it's back to the polls we go.
I have just chaired a meeting of the Cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election.
I welcome the opportunity to put the case to the people of Britain to stand up against this government and its failed economic agenda.
I think it's really confusing. There's too many of them.
Sometimes you think, oh, shall I bother to go or not? You're confused, aren't you?
It would probably help if I knew what we were voting on.
Well, this is where This Is Money comes in. The June the 8th general election being billed as the Brexit election. But Simon argues, well, there's far more at stake than that. He'll arm us with some money questions that we should put to those MPs who want our vote. Also today, Britain's bungling broadband giants shamed by the minnows.
People are often frustrated with poor speeds and connection dropouts, but actually it's the woeful levels of service dealing with concerns and complaints.
It's not just with our broadband providers we're being urged to shop around. We'll be revealing where in the country is being hit the hardest by energy price hikes and what you can do to keep the costs down. And we'll also be looking at when it doesn't pay to shop around and ask, is the personal loan market broken?
From a credit company's perspective, if they see lots of these appearing on your file, rather than that you're shopping around to find the best deal on one specific loan, it looks like you've gone out on some mad loan-grabbing spree.
Plus, catch up with the latest adventures of Lee Charlie Bucket Boyce as he heads out on his latest trip. And we ask, are there any practical small cars for drivers over 6 foot?
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money show on Share Radio in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website. And the lady is for U-turning.
There should be no general election until 2020.
Are you tempted in any way to call a snap election?
I think what's important, particularly having had the referendum vote, is that we have a period of stability. So I don't think there's a need for an election. I think the next election will be in 2020. I'm not going to be calling a snap election. What markets want is stability, and a general election would give them instability.
I have just chaired a meeting of the Cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election to be held on the 8th of June. I believe that at this moment of enormous national significance, there should be unity here in Westminster, not division. And that's why it's the right and responsible thing for all of us here today to vote for a general election.
You're joking. Not another one? Oh, for God's sake, I can't stand this. There's too much politics going on at the moment. Why does she need to do it?
Well, the nation's favourite pensioner, Brenda, there, speaking, I imagine, for many as the country faces the prospect of heading to the polls for the third time in just 2 years. MPs, though, overwhelmingly backed a snap general election on June the 8th, voting in favour 522 to just 13. Well, despite the gloomy polls for Labour, Jeremy Corbyn says the result is not a foregone conclusion.
I welcome the opportunity for us to put the case to the people of Britain to stand up against this government and its failed economic agenda, which has left our NHS in problems, which has left our schools underfunded, which has left so many people uncertain. We want to put a case out there for the people of Britain of a society that cares for all, an economy that works for all, and a Brexit that works for all.
And whether you like it or not, in just under 7 weeks, Britain will be voting in the election we're told that we need. Emphasis will, of course, be on leaving the EU. But Simon, no, he won't be distracted by the Brexit smoke and mirrors from the key money issues that we should be talking about and really grilling our MPs on. We'll be running through these shortly. But first, I wanted to get your views, your general views on the decision by Theresa May to call a snap general election, and also the view of the market, because the sterling soared to its highest level in more than 6 months on the news in a widely volatile trading session after the announcement.
I'm not surprised to see the pound going up, and I'm also not surprised, given that, to see the FTSE 100 having its worst day for a number of months. Because if you think about it, the FTSE makes well over two-thirds of its profits overseas. And consequently, if the pound goes up, those profits in dollars, in yen, in euros, in whatever currency you like, are not worth as much. And it's driven the FTSE 100 up, the pound's decline over recent months, but now you're getting the reverse impact of that. And what's really fascinating is seeing which shares are actually up within the FTSE 100. And it's very more domestic-oriented shares. Things like Next, the clothing retailer. People like EasyJet, which actually is a benefit to them. In market terms, we call it mix. And so investors are now having to think, do we look at a different type of share? Particularly, as you say, the IMF are saying that UK economic growth might be a bit better. Now, this is only in line with what the UK budget said, to be brutally honest. And if you take a look at what they're saying about next year, they're still talking about only 1.5% growth, which is not great. But overall, on the day, FTSE 100 going down, the pound going up seems to be perfectly logical.
And that was founder of Financial Orbit, Chris Bailey there. Well, a very warm welcome, Simon, a very warm welcome, Lee. We're going to get a little bit more detail about the money situation, the markets, and Simon's article this week. But Lee, I want to come to you first. It seemed to have caught everyone by surprise, which is rather unusual. We didn't get a leak of any sort, did we? Were you surprised?
Oh, Georgie, when I found out there's going to be another election, I cheered. I was like, yes, another election. Brilliant. That's just what we need. More political instability, more excitement around politics. I cannot wait. This is excellent news. Mm-hmm. But
really,
it caught everyone absolutely by surprise. I mean, it just came sort of out of nowhere. We've had, since Theresa May's been in charge, she's constantly said that she wasn't going to do a snap election, and now she's changed her mind. She's looking at the polls, and she's looking at how much of a gap there is between Conservative support compared to Labour support, with a lot of Labour supporters, you know, not seeing Jeremy Corbyn as a particular leader that they believe, you know, gives a strong opposition to the Tories. So she's looking at that and thinking, oh, get some extra seats here, we can lock this in for another 4 years. Excellent stuff, let's do it. But there's going to be a lot of people like Brenda out there who have just sort of fed up with all of this political stuff. Last year we had to decide on whether or not, you know, we left the EU. The year before that we had a general election. Can't we just have a little bit of time off just to relax and not have to think about politics for a little while? But, you know, these things always, you know, get, they're quite secret. I wouldn't have thought that's so big it wouldn't leak. And actually, when she called the meeting, and at first the pound really dipped, because people thought that she was actually standing down. It was actually like, you know,
genuinely,
yeah, that's what I read. The pound dipped momentarily when she called that surprise meeting. You know, all the cameras there. People thought she was going to step down, but then when she said there's going to be a snap election, the pound rebounded. But what this does show, the markets have had a bit of a slump since, so FTSE 100, and Simon has banged on for years and years. If you've got investments, this really is when you show that you have to stick in it for the long game, because no one saw this coming. No one saw the FTSE all of a sudden crashing like it has this week, because this has just come out of nowhere. So it does show that you shouldn't have all your eggs in one basket and you should invest for the long term. And I'm sure Simon's going to explain more.
I'm sure he is. But Simon, I do want to know, I think it was Tim Farron of the Lib Dems that said, Theresa May must have looked across to Jeremy Corbyn and thought, this is like stealing candy from a baby. Now, obviously, the polls would suggest well in the lead the Conservatives. But what was the official reason that she said? Something to do with Brexit.
Well, because people were trying to obstruct Brexit. This was the argument, that there were people who were not just debating it and putting forward their side and trying to shape it into what they thought was best, but who were just obstructing it for obstruction's sake. I mean, this was a complete surprise. So normally, as a journalist, you do get an inkling of what's going on, something that's going on. When they said that she was going to make a surprise announcement that morning, nobody knew what it was going to be about. I don't think there were many journalists or any journalists who went into work on that Tuesday morning after Easter expecting there was going to be an election called that morning. So this government is very, very good compared to previous governments at keeping things under its hat.
Well, I wonder what that says about her leadership, particularly as we're going into Brexit negotiations, that she seems to have everyone in line.
Well, yeah, she does, but then also maybe it's just also a reflection of, you know, a lot of the leaks are deliberate leaks. So, you know, previously in the past, you get on the budget day, you get half of the budget's been leaked in the week before the budget. You know, all these announcements get leaked. You know what everybody's going to announce. And maybe it's just a different style of governing that says, well, look, this constant leaking. Let's announce things when we announce them and not leak them out 2 days earlier.
But as the editor of a finance website, don't you like those leaks in a way?
Well, I suppose so, but
as a journalist,
well, yeah, you do. But I mean, I think it to be honest, I don't think it delivers a level playing field. I mean, right. Should you have a handful of people who are in favour with certain, you know, politicians or whatever, you know, knowing and others not, kind of thing? So I think it's more of a level playing field. But the reason why Theresa May has done this, the argument for why she has done this, is because what we will get is a cleaner Brexit. So the issue that Theresa May has is that she has a small majority. The majority, I think, is 17, yeah? And that means that she has to pay undue attention to the margins of her party, the people standing on the sidelines shouting, and the extremes of her party, who basically have the ability to frustrate plans to get things through, even though there may be a relatively small number of them. Because if you can get 20 MPs together, then all of a sudden you can block the government getting something through. So someone can be coming to Theresa May and saying, well, we don't like this, what you're saying about this bit on Brexit. And so, you know, we've got this group of 25 MPs and we all say we don't like it and we're going to stop you getting it through. And all of a sudden it makes it very difficult to come up with stuff. And initially what was put forward, and I think the concern of many people, is that a greater Tory majority, you know, a majority of 100 or something, would push us more towards a hard Brexit. There's a lot of people out there who are very uncomfortable with that. There are people out there who will have voted to leave the European Union who are not happy about the direction that is taken, the hard Brexit direction is taken. There are people who voted to remain in the European Union who have accepted that they voted remain, other people voted leave, they lost, and so we're leaving, but are also deeply unsettled by the direction that some of this has taken, the sense of doing things for the sake of doing them. And there's the fear that with a greater majority, we'll be pushed further down that route. But actually, there's a very strong argument that says with a greater majority, actually, we will get not necessarily a softer Brexit, maybe we would, but a better Brexit, because at the moment, she can be pushed around by both extremes of her party, including those hard Brexiteers. Whereas with a majority of 100, Theresa May, who, let's face it, has basically previously generally shown herself to be a relatively sensible, moderate person who herself even, you know, campaigned on the Remain side, looks much more likely to be able to lay out what is a more middle ground plan, one that is better for everyone, and then stick to it without having either polar end of that party saying, no, we're going to stop you with a relatively small number of people.
So you're pretty relaxed about it. What about the markets?
Well, I miss my initial reaction was very similar to Brenda's, to be perfectly honest.
I think
I'm not
a big
fan. You know, I can see the argument. Look, I can see the argument for it. And yes, I suppose probably it is for the greater good. I myself have deep concerns about what will happen with a much bigger majority and another 5 years of that. And, you know, I've had people, friends say to me, you know, maybe this doesn't come down to just like this is about choosing the people who are most competent to run the country. Maybe it's ideological this time and you have to choose sides, kind of thing. And I think that's what the Labour Party are going to harp, you know, and the Lib Dems are going to harp on about. But the markets themselves, it was very interesting. Pound dropped, as Lee said. And then as the announcement came in, I think everyone, and here you go, there's an example of how markets wrong foot people, because I think everybody expected it to keep dropping, and all of a sudden it just went up like a rocket and just kept going up all day.
Why?
It didn't stop going up until the afternoon. Well, because I think people weighed it up and thought, oh, well, hang on a minute. With this greater majority, we might get this cleaner, less chaotic Brexit. And that was exactly what it reflected. It was like less chaos, because I think what is being priced into the low value of the pound is the potential for a chaotic Brexit, as in everyone's hoping that we get it right, but everyone knows it might turn a bit chaotic. Now, if Theresa May has a majority of 100, it's much less likely to turn chaotic for all the reasons that we just spoke about. So the pound went up, and obviously at the same time the FTSE 100 went down, because basically the trade ever since pretty much a week after Brexit has been pound falls, stock market goes up, because all of those big international earnings get translated back into more pounds and pence. So a low pound is better for the FTSE's big companies.
Lee said it's a great example of when you should hold steady, be in it for the long term if you're an investor. So you shouldn't be changing strategy?
No, you shouldn't. But I tell you what, it's a good example of why you should diversify and you shouldn't have all your eggs in one basket, and why you should also always weigh up the contrarian the contrarian side of things. Because it was a great you know, sort of comment on this put out by Justin Urquhart Stewart of Seven Investment Management this week, where he said, you know, this is a classic example of how people get wrong-footed and why you should always try and think about the opposite end of things to the consensus, because the consensus has been pound's going to keep falling, FTSE's going to keep going up. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, completely out of the blue, comes this event, pound suddenly rockets up, FTSE falls. And I mean, the FTSE 100 has now given up all of the gains that it's seen since the start of the year. Mm-hmm. And up until Tuesday, the FTSE 100 was having a pretty good year.
We'll get on to the money matters in a few moments, Simon. But Lee, I just want to ask you, do we know anything about what's being promised in the election manifesto? Is it all going to be about Brexit? I mean, we did hear about Labour pledging to keep the triple lock for the pension in place until 2025. I mean, do we know anything else?
It's going to slowly start trickling out in the next couple of months ahead of the election. And set your diary, get excited, Georgie, because there may be TV debates.
Theresa May said no.
She's kind of looking like she's changed her mind on that as well.
Well, yeah. But wouldn't be a first.
These things will start to trickle out, and Georgie, it's so much politics. It's so much. It's too much. I don't know what to do. My head's frazzled by it all. But the triple lock, obviously, that has been a big thing in the last few years, and it's made sure that pensioners have seen, you know, their pensions go up over time. So things like that, I mean, they're quite key things. But unfortunately, I just don't know if Jeremy Corbyn and saying that the triple
lock... going to take more than the triple lock.
Yeah, I don't think it's really... I just think it's going to go over people's heads. And unfortunately, I just can't see him being strong enough opposition leader to make any kind of...
Is it a cakewalk, though? Is it cakewalk for Theresa May and the Conservatives?
It's really hard to say. It's not. But then again, Leicester City won the league last year. So I mean, what do I know? Donald Trump's the president of America. I mean, nothing would surprise me anymore. Anything could happen. The Green Party could win. I mean, I don't know. But no, look, I think it's a pretty much a shoo-in that it's going to turn out the way it's predicted. But I will never forget 2 years ago, the general election at 10 p.m. when that exit poll came out, and the look of people's faces in the BBC studio when they were predicting a conservative majority, and people were just so taken aback by it, because a lot of the noise was that it was going to be very, very close, and it wasn't, and it didn't turn out that way. So they're saying the gap is so massive. I just cannot see, barring some sort of absolute dynamite on Theresa May, how anything's going to change.
Mm. Well, let's be honest, the polls are always right, aren't they, Lee?
Especially recently.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, inevitably, though, as we've been saying, the campaigns surrounding this will all be, or predominantly be, about Brexit, seen by some as a proxy second referendum. Yet this election should not just be about how we leave the EU, says you, Simon. There is more at stake here, and we should use this as an opportunity to really quiz our MPs on, well, specifically money matters, because that's what you do. So, Simon, why did you feel the need to pen this article at all?
Well, because I think that it's easy to lose track of all the other things due to Brexit. And I mean, do you remember the comment from the listener when you said about the dust having settled on Brexit, the dust still being able to be seen from space? Well, I mean, if you thought we'd reach peak Brexit around the triggering of Article 50 time, think again. Mm-hmm. We are not at peak Brexit yet. But there is a life outside of Brexit. There is a country,
really,
that must trundle along, deal with some of the other small problems that we appear to be sweeping under the carpet. And so I think it is worth asking these questions. So if your local party members turn up on your doorstep canvassing and asking for your vote, if you get lucky and your MP does it, and I tell you what, if I get lucky and my MP does it, I will be a very lucky man indeed, because my MP is Jeremy Corbyn.
Oh, yeah.
So if you are listening, look me up on your database. I'd love to see you on my doorstep. But basically, you know, I just thought of some of the things that have happened and some of the questions you should be asking. Now, some of these are some of the things that this government has done since it was elected. And I think, quite rightly, the comment from many of our readers on some of these things and from us has been that we're not too happy with some of them. Possibly in some instances because we think they're a bit sneaky. And possibly in other instances because we don't remember voting for these things or even being told about them. So, just a quick rundown.
Mm.
So, I'll run you through what they are and what we should be asking. Tax squeeze on the self-employed. We saw the flat rate VAT scheme, which is very popular with the small businesses and self-employed, changed. We saw an attempt to raid the self-employed for national insurance in the budget that then had to be reversed. Are we supporting small business? Are we targeting it? What's going on here? The dividend tax allowance raid. George Osborne whacked up tax rates on dividend payments to try and capture people paying themselves dividends rather than salaries, and brought in a tax-free allowance of £5,000 to cushion the blow for investors and entrepreneurs. And then Philip Hammond just slashed that allowance down to £2,000 but kept the higher tax rates. What are their thoughts on this? Again, people very angry about this, you know. And these are all things the Tories have done. So if you're a Tory voter and you think, well, I just vote Tory, I always vote Tory, I'm not voting for Corbyn. Well, when these people turn up on your doorstep, ask them what they're doing, what they think they're doing, and why they should not do anything about it.
Lots of these that you're mentioning are very, I would imagine, issues that Tory voters would be particularly interested in.
Yeah, particularly interested in. So this is the thing. People shouldn't just blindly vote with party allegiance. Mm. Or if they are just going to vote for the Tories, whatever, they should at least hold them to account. And, I mean, at least have some fun with the person who turns up on your doorstep who isn't going to have the faintest idea about any of these things. Pensions, annual and lifetime allowances have been cut. I mean, the lifetime allowance is absolutely ridiculous, and tax relief is threatened. I mean, this penalises saving. Where is the coherent plan to stop tinkering and encourage saving? Cutting back on benefits for bereaved families. Another one from the government at the moment. Can they explain this astonishing cut from 20 years worth of help for a family who loses a parent to 18 months? Mm. Again, not a popular one. Raising the tax-free earnings personal allowance. Now, this is a good thing. The government has done this. It did it under the coalition as well. It's been a great thing for the low-paid. Are they committed to continuing it? The tax-free savings allowance, one close to Lee's heart. You can earn £1,000 worth of interest now with no tax, or £500 if you're a higher-rate taxpayer. Is this safe? Do they promise to protect it? Then also your favourite thing, Georgie, house prices and the property market. So, yes, we don't build enough homes, but that is only a small part of the problem. Basically, we have been far too dependent on property in this country for our economy for many, many years. George Osborne rolled the dice on it again to get the economy moving and get a recovery going. We tax it like high house prices are a good thing and a benefit. They're not a benefit. They skew the economy. They mean people don't move home. They don't take entrepreneurial risks. What on earth are you going to do about that one? Come up with a plan is what I would challenge any politician. And finally, the other big questions. What will you do about inequality, the NHS and social care, and how will you pay for this? So ask those questions to the people who turn up on your doorstep and see what they say. At least hold them to account, even if you're just going to vote for them anyway.
I think Simon's earned a little break there, don't you think?
I think if
it's feet up, cup of tea.
If your MP turns up, you're going to have to stock up with tea bags.
Just play him this clip, yeah?
This is Money, in partnership with NS&I. Have any premium bond prizes you win paid directly into your bank account.
Very warm welcome to This Is Money show in the studio with me, editor Simon Lambert, and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. Now, big isn't always better. I'm not talking about the problem of fitting into little cars if you're vertically advantaged. We will actually get onto that a little bit later. No, I'm talking about broadband providers. Oh dear, oh dear, for the big boys. Ranked as among the worst in a customer poll. TalkTalk, BT, Sky, EE. Beaten by smaller competitors on everything from basic service, speed, reliability and tech support. It was little known Minnows, Zen Internet and Utility Warehouse, who they, which top which's customer satisfaction surveys. Well, Pete Morey is from the Consumer Group.
Broadband's now seen as an essential service, and yet we've found once again that it's the biggest internet service providers that are failing on basic customer service, on speed and on reliability. And this is particularly concerning considering that the ones who are right at the bottom of our table, BT, EE, Sky and TalkTalk, occupy over 70% of the market share. Clearly people are often frustrated with things like poor speeds and connection dropouts, but actually it's the woeful levels of service, dealing with people's concerns and complaints and providing tech support where these big internet providers often seem to score so badly. And it's these basics that we really expect them to do much better on. It shows very clearly that these small providers are doing really, really well and providing excellent service for their customers. But these big providers really need to up their game. Why is it when they are so large, they have so many customers that they are struggling to do the basics when the small companies seem to be doing so much better. And so I think we want to see the big providers looking at these survey results we'll be sharing with them and telling us what it is they're going to do to up their game, because sadly year on year we're seeing very, very similar results where some of these big players are failing on the basics.
Well, that was Pete Morey from Which There. Lee, as Consumer Affairs Editor, this one, I believe, falls to you. But first, how important is good broadband now to the economy? The way he's talking there, it's like a utility, isn't it? It's like water or,
It is a utility now. You know, it's, people rely on it. You know, lots of people work from home, for example, need access to their emails or need access to certain systems, and they need a solid, reliable, fast internet service to do that. But on a personal level, a lot of people now rely on the internet to stay in touch with people and connect with people, whether it be family that's around, you know, across the world. And people do use it like a utility now. I think if you went into most households and said, we're cutting off your broadband, it'd be like losing a limb to a lot of people now. You know, we've come to rely on it. And this survey reveals just how poor a service a lot of people are getting.
Well, tell us a little bit more about this survey. What categories are they particularly looking for? Because the way Pete was talking there, it's just they're generally doing the basics wrong.
Exactly. And I do sometimes sympathise with big firms like this because, they do have a lot of customers. But, you know, it's their own fault, isn't it? They've been...
Which I'm sure they're benefiting
from.
They
want all the customers. Yeah, they advertise heavily and they lure you in with deals that might expire after 12 months and people find it difficult to cancel and go elsewhere. It's not a very fluid market. It could, done better, without these big... One of the gripes we get, cancellation fees, for example. You know, you might sign up for a 12-month contract and in 4 months' time or 6 months' time, you might move house and they want you to pay a cancellation fee. Like, it's just ridiculous. It needs to be a little bit more sort of softy approach in some of these firms, especially the ones that, have got low satisfaction scores. And when people do get their backs up about a firm, they're going to complain about it, and I don't blame them. You want a good... you want a good broadband speed. You want a good customer service. And it goes wrong, you want to call up a call centre and you want them to be able to fix it. Or if you need to get an engineer out, you want the engineer to turn up at the time that they say they're going to turn up, not just when it suits them. I think actually broadband is one of these areas that could do with a lot more competition, and these smaller providers are starting to get there, but it's very hard when the big four have something like 75% of the market share. I mean, that is a huge amount of customers. Bottom of the pile, actually, of this Which survey is TalkTalk. And it's had a rough time of it in the last couple of years. You think about the data hack, didn't do its image very good. And it's still maybe suffering from a bit of that. And people, are not getting the service that they want. I mean, it's got a satisfaction score of 38%. Yeah. I mean, that's not good, is it? Followed by BT at 45%. These firms need to be doing more. But is Ofcom doing anything about it? It's one of these regulators.
Well, BT did get fined, didn't they, last month?
It did get fined. And actually, it was quite hefty. I must admit, it was quite a hefty fine.
42 million, was it?
42 million quid is not a small fine. But on the whole, I just feel like Ofcom could be doing more. We've had a whole campaign in the last couple of years about line rental, for example. Well, line rental, for example, one provider of one of the big providers will put up the line rental by, let's say, £1 or £1.50 a year, and then all the others just follow suit. Well, they've done it, so we'll do it. When is that going to get cracked down? No one really uses their home phone anymore.
Don't we have a competition authority to sort that out?
Which is exactly it, Georgie. But what are these guys doing? Okay, yeah, BT did get fined £42 million last year with Ofcom, and Ofcom are obviously trying to make an example of them. But, it's one of these utilities that I think we need to get more smaller providers in. And the big problem is that a lot of it is sort of dealt with by Openreach, which is a BT company, and there's been lots of talks about it splitting up and carving it up. Maybe that does need to be done because, you're likely to have Openreach come round and sort out your internet no matter what provider you're with. I mean, I'm with Plusnet, and it was only up until about 6 months ago that I realised it's owned by BT. It's just BT dressed up as Plusnet. And that's got a 65% satisfaction rating, so perhaps BT should just scrap it or just rename itself Plusnet.
Well, that's interesting because we have that with some of the banks as well, don't we? Some of the smaller banks, they seem to do pretty well in these customer satisfactions, and then you work out they're actually owned by bigger banks. Yeah, they aren't doing so well. So
exactly, yeah. Because
is there a perception here in our minds?
They just don't have the legacy probably of a lot of old customer problems and that sort of thing, and they can probably come in at a lower price point, and people don't wake up and realise that they're just essentially the same company. But also, in terms of smaller providers as well, and we've seen this in the energy market, if they start getting swamped with customers, that's when the satisfaction scores start going down because they might expand too quickly. So, you know, hopefully these companies that are scoring well will just grow organically and pretty slowly and not try and go on a big drive to get customers, because that's where, on the whole, unfortunately, we usually see customer meltdowns.
Simon, I'm going to ask you, and this is probably pretty unpopular. You can understand why regulators don't want to get involved in this, but Lee's pointed out there that, you know, 72 market share for the big boys on this. If you are too big to provide a great service, is there an argument for someone stepping in and saying, now, look, sorry, you're going to have to cut yourself up. You're too big.
That'd be a good idea, wouldn't it? So basically, you're rated on your customer satisfaction and on your complaints and on whether you're providing a good service. And if you don't, if you don't pass muster, if you don't get yourself above a certain level, or you fall below it for too long, you get broken up.
Yeah.
Is that your plan?
Why not?
I like that. I like that a lot.
I like that a lot.
It's like you're too big to fail.
You're too big to handle. What you've got too much on your hands, you're going to have to get rid of some.
And it is an issue because obviously if you look at a big company, then companies will be measured on the money that they make, but also on the customers that they have. And customer growth is much harder to achieve if you have millions upon millions of customers, because you could add 200,000 customers and it would look like your customer base had hardly grown at all. And obviously if you're dealing with what is essentially a mature market, as in there's not lots more people coming through, I wouldn't imagine there's much of a growth in households needing broadband nowadays, is there? I mean, surely, you know, there's a fairly limited number of households. We've always already established that we're not building many more new homes, so until people start getting numerous broadband connections in the same property, which of course they don't need, then there's no growth coming in there. So you've got to basically just be stealing them off other people. So yeah, maybe you should be able to. I think what's interesting is that, as Lee said, the line rental thing. I mean, the excuse that always gets trotted out about line rental is, oh well, we've got to pay for improving the line rental for your broadband. And it's like, well, what am I paying the money for my broadband for then? Hang on a minute. So I'm paying you £17.50 for my line rental. And that's got to be £17.50, not £10, because it's going towards the upkeep of the broadband. But I'm also paying you £17.50 for my broadband. So what on earth's that going on? So yeah, I mean, there's a good question there about what they're up to. But I suppose we should count ourselves lucky in a sense. But as I understand it, internationally speaking, our internet is not up to scratch.
Lee, I just want to ask you, I mean, a lot of this, as it always the way, is this emphasis on us to switch around. You pointed out, though, that when one raises their prices, so do the others. It's an internet and utility warehouse, and I imagine there's plenty more out there like those. What do we know about them? Or is it worth switching over to them?
Well, the proof is in the pudding. And actually, first of all, you have to go onto these websites and type in your postcode to see if you can actually get the provider in question, because some of them are regionally based or can't offer the service in your home. I mean, for example, Virgin, quite often you'll move somewhere and Virgin, because they run on a sort of different system, you can't get Virgin even if you wanted to. You know, you have to read the reviews and see how good they are. But I would encourage people to switch. I think there's a lot of people out there that, you know, are just with BT because they've always been with BT, and then 15 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, they've got the internet of BT and it's kind of been okay. But I think you should go on a website and check your speed and see what speed you're getting and what speed you should, you know, advertise to be getting, and then have a shop around, like anything, you know, and give something else a try and see if they offer you a good enough service. If they don't, then switch.
I can give you an example of some people getting a really lousy service, actually. I did my mother and father-in-law a favour the other day and helped them to move their broadband, because it'd been with the same people for ages. And they were with Plusnet and they were on some kind of legacy tariff, and I looked into trying to get them upgraded to fibre optic. And I discovered that basically the price that they were being quoted to upgrade within their own, with it, if I did it within their account rather than looking at the prices for new customers, was much, much higher. So I called up Plusnet and eventually I managed to get through. And it was explained to me that it's because they're in a rural area. So they've got higher prices because they're rural. But they also, because they're in a rural area, they don't have fibre optic broadband in the area, so they get a worse service. So basically, they have to pay more for a worse service because they're in a rural area. They live in Hertfordshire. They live in basically a triangle between three major towns, 10 minutes from the M25. They're not like up a hill in Yorkshire in the middle of nowhere. They are basically...
Imagine how much they're paying.
If you drive 5 minutes to the nearest station, you are 25 minutes from the centre of London. Yet they are paying more money for their broadband because they're in a rural area and getting a worse service. How is that right, I ask you?
I don't know. Well, talking of switching providers and, to a certain degree, postcode lotteries when it comes to service, on This Is Money, you've highlighted where families are being hit hardest by energy price hikes. You also have some useful advice about what you can do to try and mitigate some of those rises. But millions of us across the country have seen gas and electricity bills rise between 1 and 10%, adding, on average, £97 to annual bills. Now, it's after five of the big six suppliers announced increases to their standard variable tariff rate. It's those in the east and the northwest who are feeling it the most, it seems. Lee, tell us a little bit more.
Oh, I don't know about that, Georgie. It's a map of how much your bill is going to go up, depending whereabouts you are in the country, done by Money Supermarket. And to be quite honest with you, the map, it shows basically everyone's bills are going up roughly by about the same amount of money. There's a slight discrepancy here and there, but I mean, on the whole, everyone's going to be paying almost £100 a year more for their gas and electric this year. It's thanks to lots of price rises from, as you say, five of the big six. One of them, EDF, has done two price hikes in 6 months. I mean, fantastic. Fantastic news for...
Thank you very much.
Thanks, EDF, for that. That's fantastic.
Why are they doing it, Lee?
They're just blaming rising in wholesale costs. And to be fair, the last couple of years, we have seen wholesale costs come down and bills come down. But, you know, it's one of those things. When wholesale costs go down, you know, bills go down a little bit, and then as soon as wholesale prices nudge up, they go up like a rocket, which is just their common practice. But, you know, the point of this research is that you can save money by switching. And, you know, what Money Supermarket is saying here, that the average household could save between £350 to £400 a year by switching. And that is a lot of cash. The discrepancies between each region are very small, and it is all in that ballpark. But the best thing to do is just get yourself on an energy comparison tool like ours that we've got on our website, thisismoney.co.uk. Tap in your postcode and see what deals best for you. And actually, quite a few fixed energy deals are coming up, not just from the big six, but other providers that people might have switched to in recent years. And just go for the cheapest option, in my opinion. Energy, for me, you're not going to get a worse standard of energy. You might get a worse standard of customer service if something goes wrong. No, I just think energy, just go for the cheapest one. It's not like you're going to start getting blackouts or anything. It's not like you get good quality energy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like broadband where you get a good or a bad connection. Energy is energy. If you're not getting your electricity or your gas, then why are you going to pay someone at £400 a year more for it?
Simon?
Energy isn't just energy. Okay. Because it's better than that, right? You can just go for the cheapest person. And if you really don't care, just go for the cheapest person. Because as we discovered when one of these small energy funds went bust, basically, Ofgem has a plan in place. They stepped in, they saved them. Your lights aren't going to go out. They just got shifted. Your power, you know, comes through basically all the same. It doesn't just suddenly stop. We saw an energy supplier go bust this year. Didn't cause anybody any troubles. Nobody's TV went off in the middle of Coronation Street.
Thank goodness for that.
So Lee's right. Energy is energy. If you don't care, just go for the cheapest. Or alternatively, get some green energy. So you can do a comparison, and you can get all of your electricity from renewable sources. So my energy is with OVO. So it's not with a big company. So there you go. Tick. Not supporting big company. Mm-hmm. And it all comes from renewable sources. So it all comes from wind or solar or whatever. So that's great. I've made that choice, and it means I pay a little bit more than paying the absolute cheapest. But I still ended up saving about £250 a year compared to what I was paying before. So there you go. You can even save money and help the environment. And how often do people tell you that?
Not very often. We've spoken about the benefits of shopping around for the best deal, but... Guys, we heard this week, didn't we, that actually doing just that could cost you. Now, if you're looking for a personal loan, watch out, as it could damage your credit rating. TSB's chief exec, Paul Pester, has gone a step further, saying the whole personal loan market is broken. It's been stacked against consumers for far too long. Now, the bank reckons underhand tactics is costing Brits as much as £400 million each year, as consumer editor at Good Housekeeping, Sarah Benwell, explains.
There's an awful lot of consumers, about 1 million a year, are doing what everybody always tells them to do before they do buy a financial product and shopping around. But when you look at a personal loan, there's the advertised rate, which is the rate that only people with the very best credit ratings get. For most people, you'll get a personalised rate of interest, which will depend on your personal credit history. So if you want to shop around and find out what kind of loan you can get from a bank, you have to apply for the loan. Mm-hmm. So you have to say to them, OK, I want to take out this loan for £10,000 that I want to pay back over 15 years. What will the interest rate be? And what's happening is the vast majority of financial institutions, in order to give you that quote, are doing something called a hard credit check. And what that does is it leaves a note on your credit file which says this person has looked at a loan or applied for a loan. And the problem is, from a credit company's perspective, if they see lots of these appearing on your file, rather than that you're shopping around to find the best deal on one specific loan, it looks like you've gone out on some mad loan-grabbing spree where you've tried to borrow like £100,000 from 10 different people. And what that can do is, what that does tend to do is increase the interest rate you'll actually end up paying on your one loan by as much as 1.75%. So if you were trying to borrow £10,000 and you shopped around, you could end up spending £364 a year extra in interest just because you shopped around.
Because you're being savvy.
And with almost any other financial product, if you're buying insurance, if you're buying anything else, shopping around tends to get you a better deal. But in this case, it's actually ending up leaving a load of consumers much, much worse off, a million consumers much, much worse off.
Lee, why has this only come to light now?
It's because St. Paul Pester of Challenger Bank, TSB.
Challenger Bank, you're a big fan of that, aren't you?
Who has been holier than ho in his career, has decided to step up and say, actually, wait a minute, people are getting marks on their files when they're applying for personal loan rates, which have come down to absolute lows. I mean, you can get a personal loan now for about 3.2, 3.3% if you've got a good credit record. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 51% of people have to get that advertised rate, but that means quite a lot of people don't. And people may not know what rate they're going to get until they've gone through that credit search. Now, what some providers do is that they just do a soft search until you really do commit and say you want this loan. And that means it's almost just like a little tinkering on your credit file. You know, it's clear that you haven't gone through and actually got the money. But a hard search, which some banks do, just if you're applying and not even getting the money, but actually find out what rate you can get, it looks a lot more serious on your credit record. And that can be quite devastating if you're looking to buy a home or get car finance. So it's actually quite important to know, before you go ahead with a bank or a challenger bank you're going to get a loan with, what kind of search they're going to do. And especially if you're about to buy a home, because that can really sort of derail your bid to get that place, because it looks bad on your credit
record.
Well,
how do you know which is going to do which check?
Well, we have got a listener. So our colleagues at Money Mail sort of had a look round. And you should ask them. They should be up front with you. They should be able to tell you what kind of search they're going to do on your credit record. So I saw that Santander were one that do a hard credit mm-hmm. search on there. And there were numerous other examples that I haven't got to hand right now. But just make sure that they're just going to do a soft search on it.
OK, so St. Paul pulled no punches on this one. Some of the language he used: loan market broken, stacked against consumers for too long, underhand tactics. Simon, what are they going to do to change this? Is it broken?
I'll tell you what is broken about it. I mean, this hard search thing, you know, we've been telling people about this for years. It's not new.
Ooh.
It's not. We've been telling people about it, and all of our other rival publications have been telling people about it, you know. I don't know. Maybe he picked up a couple of back copies or read some old internet articles.
Discovered the internet. He finally changed dramatically. You know,
he moved away from
the church. OK, there is an issue here, and I'll tell you what the real issue here is. The real issue here is the fact that for that advertised rate, only 51% of successful applicants have to get that advertised rate. And what happens if you don't get that advertised rate is you get a considerably higher rate. And actually, for many people who would apply for a loan, they are not getting the 3% of this world. They are getting more like credit card rates. They're getting 12%, 15%, things like that. And that's a real issue if you've built up debt over time and you're actually trying to pay that debt off. You know, people do need to borrow money for things. They might need to borrow money for a new kitchen, they might spread the cost, they might need to borrow it for an extension or something like that. But if you're one of those people who's got this chunk of debt and they want to pay it off, then you don't get to benefit from this wonderful world of 3% mm-hmm. personal loan rates. You're stuck in this horrible world of not getting those 3%. You're not in the 51% who gets the successful applicants. You get the much higher rate, and it becomes much harder to pay off your debts. And I don't think that banks, building societies and credit card companies are doing enough to help those people. They're offering them, you know, endless 0% balance transfers. And let's you know, remind ourselves, why does your credit card company offer to lend you money interest free for 40 months? Is it because it's nice? Is it because it's altruistic? Is it because it just likes to help you out? No, it's because enough people fall foul of the rules that credit card companies make tons of money when they instead slip onto a much higher interest rate. So what's happening is we've got all of these financial institutions that have dished out a huge amount of consumer debt, and then you've got the people who actually want to take out a perfectly sensible loan, pay it off over 5 years, and all of a sudden they find that they cannot get a decent rate to get it on. And I think that what they need to be doing is putting their hands up, owning up to the situation and saying, if you are a person who is using a loan to basically pay off your debts, and we can check up on this, we can, you know, make sure that you're not using the money for something else, you keep up with the payments and everything else like that, we will commit to offering you a good rate rather than bumping you all of a sudden from that 3% to a much higher rate. And I think that's the real reason why the loan market is broken in this country.
All right. Time to put all that depressing stuff to one side of price hikes, debt, politics and the like. Yep, it's time for the latest update in the adventures of Lee Charlie Bucket Boyce. Fresh from his trips to the Royal Mint and Aldi headquarters, this time he donned his white coat and fetching hairnet to visit... Where did you go, Lee?
It wasn't just a hairnet, George. You had to put a beard net on. I've never had a beard in my life. I can't grow a beard. I was like, I need a beard net? What do you mean?
No, they were taking the mick out of you.
No, I felt quite good. I was like, oh, geez, yeah, I've got a bit of stubble these days. Yeah, lovely. I was at the new epicentre of coffee roasting, Georgie, in Basildon, Essex, the glamour. I do get sent out to some absolute glamorous places. I went actually because I don't live too far away, and I saw it. I saw it being built.
Fair enough.
I saw it being built, and it piqued my interest. And actually, it's a very interesting story. Costa has been a very big British success story. Mm-hmm. It only had 41 branches in 1995, and Whitbread took it over. It's now got more than 3,000, and it's the second biggest coffee chain in the world behind Starbucks. So it's a good British success story. It was set up by some Italian brothers in the 70s. Mm-hmm. They roasted their coffee in Lambeth. They've just outgrown that site. So their new site in Basildon is four times the size, and it's shipping coffee. So they get the coffee beans in, which are green when they come in, rock hard beans that they then slowly roast through these really impressive Willy Wonka-esque machines. There's pipes, there's tubes, there's vats. There's a testing centre where coffee beans come through to be tested. It was a really fascinating trip. And so these beans come in from around the world. I found out that Vietnam is the second biggest coffee bean produced in the world. So the coffee that you drink from Costa is partly made up of beans from Vietnam.
There you go.
I've never knew that. You know, you think of Brazil, which is the top one, mm-hmm. but then also places like Colombia and some other South American countries, El Salvador and Costa Rica, those sort of places. But anyway, they get these beans and they put them through these vats, and they roast this coffee and it gets shipped around the world. So not only stores, shops in Britain, but also China. They've got 400 shops in China now, Costa. They're really sort of driving into that market where perhaps Starbucks hasn't quite gotten there. Whereas, you know, America's quite big for coffee, so it's unlikely that Costa are going to go over there. But it was really interesting to see the process, how it's all done. So I had the tour and then I went up into the lab. So they do have a lab, and every single bag of beans that come in from whichever country are tested before they come to the factory. So when they arrive on the ship in Tilbury Docks, which is about a 20-minute drive away from Basildon, there's a lab technician who's got a little team, and they get some of the beans and they look at they get a scoop of these beans and they look for impurities, they look for cracks in these beans, and they turn down 8% of the beans. They say, you know, they're not good enough, and they will roast them and they will drink them. It's three cups, three testers. So if there's two that say yes, that's good enough, and one that says no, it goes through. There's always going to be a result, in other words. But the master of coffee there, which is a great job title, that, isn't it? What do you do for a living? I'm the master of coffee.
Yeah,
it's fantastic. His tongue is insured for £10 million.
Wow.
Because he's tasting the coffee that comes in, every single bag that comes in, and it's a blend of two different beans in your Costa coffee. Every single cup of that has had some beans tested to make sure that they're good enough. And he put me through my paces as a barista. which I've got utmost respect for that. But back in my day, it used to be you worked in a pub, probably at university, you know, putting pints, and it was fairly leisurely, except if you had a rush on. In a coffee shop, you're dealing with hot liquids. A lot of people expect it now, fast, quick. And there's been a massive rise in coffee shops. And it was quite difficult making this coffee. I definitely won't quit my day job to become a barista. But it was great.
Do you know what? I don't think I've heard him so excited since he went to the Royal Mint. I'm going to blow your mind and say those two beans are Arabica and Robusta. And Costa's expression was from bean to cup. How do I know this? Because in 2001, I spent 2 days at their old roastery at Costa College School because I was a barista for many years at Costa. There are other coffee shops available. I was also one for Nero as well. So I have to say, I know a lot of what you were saying there, Lee, but I have forgotten it because you had to have an exam at the end of it.
Yeah, so when I went to this Basildon Roastery, they've opened a new training centre there. There was a fresh batch of students in there and I saw them doing their exam. And I was like, this is quite cool. Like, there's quite a level of, you know, expertise. But the important burning question, did you enjoy the job, Georgie?
I loved it. Do you know, it's one of my favourite jobs I've ever done. Hey. I absolutely enjoyed it immensely. The location was not too glamorous. It was Road Chef on the M25. but I loved it. And it was back in the day when you had to explain to people that espresso was not the little one because it's the cheapest. It's little because it's really strong.
Yeah, exactly.
Nowadays,
yeah.
Can you imagine saying that to people that come in? Do you really want an espresso? And I tell you what, 95% of them said, oh, actually, no, I just want a normal black coffee.
Yeah, exactly.
Nowadays,
yeah.
Well, you'd get your coffee thrown over you if you sort of so patronising as that.
I love the fact that all of this effort and all of this testing goes into supplying coffee in coffee shops where the vast majority of the population then ask for a bucket of milk to be tipped on top of it.
Very true, Simon.
And there I declare my hand as a coffee snob. A coffee snob who says it is not a coffee if it is a massive bucket of milk with a small amount of coffee in the bottom. It is a coffee if it has a small amount of milk on the top and you can taste the coffee.
All right, Simon, all right. Well, talking of size, it really does matter, apparently. Small cars, economical, cheap to insure and buy, and ideally suited to city living. Not ideally suited if you are blessed in the height department. The long and short of it is there are some rather compact super minis that are perfectly suited, though, to people over 6 feet tall. And you've actually been taking a look at the best little cars for bigger people.
It instantly makes me think of Mr. Bean in a mini. I don't know why, just that's the first thing that springs to mind. But there are cars, apparently smaller cars, that perhaps taller people, you know, would avoid because they think they're going to be too small, but actually have a surprising amount of room, especially as smaller cars now don't seem to be anywhere near as small as what they once were. If you think about old
a mini's
school,
a lot bigger, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. If a mini's now just like a standard car, you know, the old school mini, Fiat 500, I mean, that's still quite small, but the old Fiat 500, there used to be one down my road from the sort of 60s, 70s. It's so small. It looks like a clown car. I don't know how anyone over sort of 5 foot could get in there. But we've had a look at the ones and actually looked at the width, how much leg room you've got. And if you are after sort of a smaller car, which are going to cost less to run, Hyundai i20, it's come up quite high. Kia Rio. The Mini Hatch, 5-door. Skoda Fabia, that's a solid runaround. Ford Fiesta, which has been the best-selling car since Mr. Bean first aired. I mean, that's how popular that one is. And the Volkswagen Polo. But the two to avoid, the Fiat 500. If you're over 6 foot, not sure that's really going to be the car for you, unless you like to exit a car sort of like Peter Crouch, you know, stepping out. And the Vauxhall Adam is another one that's not got much leg room, according to the research. So
Vauxhall Adam.
Yeah,
just run out of ideas for names. That's rubbish.
It's like hurricanes now. They just name them after people. So that's when you got the Vauxhall Barrys coming up.
And Charlie, Eddie.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Simon, what's your favourite?
Out of all these cars, I think maybe the Fiesta, actually. Yeah.
It goes for the old classic.
It's the country's favourite, basically. Mm-hmm. The Fiesta is the top-selling car. And I must admit, I had a Fiesta as a hire car recently when I was going snowboarding, and I picked it up from the airport in Zurich, and they offered me the choice. And she said, which car do you want? You can have a Citroen C3 or a Ford Fiesta. And I said, I'll have the Ford Fiesta. She said, the C3's newer. I was like, oh, it's all right, I'll take the Fiesta. Because I just knew the Fiesta was a better car. The Fiesta is quite a good, fun little car to drive. And I did, you know, all the way to the mountains, up the windy mountain roads, good laugh. And unfortunately, got a speeding ticket.
Enjoyed it a lot.
Editor Simon Lovett, Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, thank you so much for joining us.
Sharing ideas about money. This is Share Radio.